Flames rushed into the air conditioning unit, spread throughout the bar, and before the Holocaust was over, 29 of my brothers and a sister were burned to death.
I started calling churches, try to get a place to hold the memorial service, and everybody turned us flatly down.
A queer serial.
One must have an attitude of total acceptance of homosexuality or lesbianism.
The completely true story of a newfound minority.
United we stand.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Lucia Chappell. Russians elect Putin for life and embed inequality, queer pioneers and the fire that time, and activism evolves in a queer serial. All that and more this week because you've tuned in to This Way Out.
I'm Brian DeShazer.
And I'm Wenzel Jones.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending July 4th, 2020. Russian voters have given Vladimir Putin what amounts to a lifetime presidency and constitutionally banned marriage equality in the process. According to the Central Election Commission, 78% approved the package of constitutional amendments. They allow Putin to stay in power until 2036. He'll be 84 years old. The vote also amends the Constitution to say that Russian values include defense of the institution of marriage as the union of a man and a woman. Marriage equality has never been a realistic goal in Putin's Russia. It will be even more challenging now with inequality baked into the amended Constitution. A campaign ad featuring a homophobic depiction of a queer family that posed the question, "Is this the Russia you want?" was so offensive that it was pulled after widespread criticism. Apparently, the Yes campaign's "Our Country, Our Constitution, Our Decision" slogan appealed to Russia's generally conservative electorate. High-profile Kremlin critic Alexei Navalny called the results a huge lie. He wrote, "I voted no, everyone voted no, and the result is a solid yes. This has nothing to do with the opinion of Russian citizens."
Meanwhile, a number of Western embassies flew the rainbow flag in Moscow to salute Global Pride Day on June 27th. A statement by representatives from Australia, Canada, New Zealand, the United Kingdom, and the United States called on the Russian government to protect the rights of LGBTQ people and to affirm the inherent dignity of each individual as expressed in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Putin spokesman Dmitry Peskov dismissed the flag waving, saying that any occurrence of propaganda of non-traditional sexual minorities in our country is prohibited by law. That's the so-called No Promo Homo law enacted in 2013 that forbids exposing minors to any pro-queer activities or speech, including pride parades. The Moscow Times reported several people posing for photos in front of the rainbow flag-draped U.S. embassy. Some people posted photos of themselves dressed in bright rainbow collars or makeup or kissing their same-gender partners. Those are courageous actions in and of themselves. A recent poll found that 1 in 5 Russians believe that LGBTQ people should be eliminated. The Russian U.S. Embassy's gesture flouts an early June order by President Donald Trump banning rainbow flags from official embassy flagpoles. Other U.S. embassies simply displayed the rainbow flag elsewhere on the embassy grounds.
Homophobic Polish President Andrzej Duda fell short of the 50% majority needed to win re-election outright in voting on June 28th. He'll face queer-supportive liberal Warsaw Mayor Rafael Trzaskowski in a July 12th runoff. Trzaskowski won about 30% of the vote. Duda's campaign included repeated references to LGBT ideology, as in, "These are not people, it is an ideology, worse than Soviet indoctrination." His Law and Justice Party has consistently preached traditional family values in the heavily Roman Catholic country. Trzaskowski urged supporters of other candidates in the race to vote for him. In his words, "This result shows one thing that is most important. Over 58% of our society wants change. I want to say clearly to all these citizens, I will be your candidate of change." The COVID-19 pandemic forced authorities to move the original election from May to June 28th. As Duda's support diminished in the interim, the main opposition Civic Platform Party replaced its original candidate with the more electable Trzaskowski. Pollsters are predicting an extremely close vote in the coming runoff.
Gabon's Senate has voted to overturn the country's law against same-gender sex. The office of President Ali Bongo Ondimba described the June 29th tally as a landslide, an even larger margin than passed the repeal in the House, according to Reuters. Ondimba is expected to sign the bill into law. Gabon joins Angola, Seychelles, Mozambique, and Botswana in overturning what were usually colonial-era statutes outlawing crimes against nature. However, in Gabon's case, the law was passed just last year. It's not clear what prompted the repeal now. Opponents cited religious beliefs as their reason for voting against the measure. 72 countries on the planet still criminalize same-gender sex, and almost half of them are on the African continent. Meanwhile, South Africa's National Council of Provinces has approved a bill to prevent marriage officers from opting out of same-gender weddings. Provisions in the 2006 Marriage Equality Law allow them that right, usually for religious reasons. The change passed in the upper house this week had already been approved by the National Assembly in 2018, according to Times Live. The bill now goes to President Cyril Ramaphosa for his expected assent.
The tiny Balkan nation of Montenegro is now the first European country outside of Western Europe and the European Union to legally recognize same-gender couples. Lawmakers voted 42-39 to create civil partnerships on July 1st. The law gives same-gender couples most of the rights of marriage, just not the name and the ability to foster or adopt children. Montenegro's parliament rejected a similar proposal just last year. No wonder John Barak of the advocacy group LGBT Forum Progress told reporters that, "I honestly wasn't expecting it." Barak called it really extraordinary. It's a big day for all of us. Montenegro would very much like to join the European Union, and the civil partnerships law is seen as a step to gaining approval. Opponents reportedly charged that civil partnerships were being imposed by global world Satanists.
India's conservative government is opening the doors of the National Central Armed Police Force to qualified transgender candidates. Officials are pointing to the Transgender Persons Protection of Rights Act, passed in December 2019. Among other protections, it bans anti-trans discrimination in the workplace. Now, the Ministry of Home Affairs says that the level playing field it gives trans people in employment should include combat policing. The ministry is now soliciting comments from the various departments of the Central Armed Police Forces, according to Press Trust of India. Then the Union Public Service Commission can prepare proper documents and procedures for transgender applicants. The Times of India reports that the Border Security Force has already expressed support for the move. Input is pending from the Central Industrial Security Force and the Indo-Tibetan Border Police. Officials say that applicants will still need to pass written exams, appropriate physical tests, and an interview process. Upon final approval, the Union Public Service Commission will be directed to modify relevant application rules and procedures to include transgender as a separate identifying category.
By contrast, the Trump administration continues its full-fledged war against transgender people. Secretary of Housing and Urban Development Ben Carson has announced a rule change that would allow federally funded homeless services to turn away transgender clients. Carson proclaimed that the umpteenth reversal of a policy established during Barack Obama's presidency will, in his words, better accommodate religious beliefs of shelter providers. The July 1st statement from Housing and Urban Development explains that the new rule allows shelter providers that lawfully operate as single-sex or sex-segregated facilities to voluntarily establish a policy that will govern admissions determinations for situations when an individual's gender identity does not match their biological sex. Not surprisingly, a number of queer and trans-specific advocacy groups quickly condemned the latest Trump assault on transgender people. The ACLU's Trans Justice Campaign Manager, Lala Zanell, stressed that this new rule would be particularly dangerous for black and brown transgender women. They are disproportionately represented among the country's unemployed and homeless population. The proposed rule change is subject to a 60-day public comment period before taking effect.
Finally, a Pride Month miracle has brightened the landscape of a small Spanish town. Three people in the Andalusian village of Villanueva de Algaidas complained about a rainbow flag flying over the council building. Spain's Supreme Court decided recently that local government buildings could only fly official flags of Spain, its regions, or the European Union. Socialist mayor of the village, Juan Civico, said he would indeed have to take the flag down, noting, but the people can put what they like on their balconies. A shopkeeper in the nearby popular LGBTQ seaside resort of Torremolinos heard the mayor's sly message. He drove to the village and handed out close to 400 rainbow flags that had been languishing on his shelves because of the COVID-19 crisis. On Pride Day, June 27th, as Reuters described it, the Nueva de Algaides was awash with flags hanging from balconies, windows, and even a bar in solidarity. Torremolinos shopkeeper Antonio Carlos Alcantara marveled that the village is full of rainbow flags. It is incredible.
That's News Wrap, global queer news with attitude for the week ending July 4th, 2020. Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap is recorded remotely during the COVID-19 emergency, but is still written by Greg Gordon, edited by Lucia Chappelle, produced by Brian DeShazer, and brought to you by you.
Help keep us in ears around the world at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast and much more.
And you can listen to News Wrap each week by subscribing to our This Way Out Radio YouTube channel. For This Way Out, I'm Wenzel Jones. Stay healthy.
And I'm Brian DeShazer. Stay safe.
Revolutionary homosexuals are on the attack.
We are? Apparently we were. That's some history that comes out in a queer podcast we'll sample later in the program. But first, the time machine makes a stop closer to home.
You talk like you've never seen the world outside these walls. In here it's some kind of paradise. Out there you roll the dice. There's no trampoline, you've got to bounce back up on your own. Don't act surprised in this life. We fight this fight.
The World Outside These Walls is from The View Upstairs, Max Vernon's off-Broadway musical dramatizing the deadly 1973 fire at New Orleans' Upstairs Lounge. That history was lived in real time by pioneering activists Morris Kite and Reverend Troy Perry. Kite reported back shortly after the tragedy to KPFK Los Angeles' Richard Golance, and Perry recalled his experience some months later for a documentary produced for Pacifica Radio by me, Lucia Chappelle.
There is a gay bar at the corner of Iverville and Chatwa, except they say charters down their street.
Morris Kite.
In the very edge of the Vaucouleurs, the French Quarter in New Orleans. It's a three-story brick building, very old, very dry, very dusty. On the first floor are two non-gay bars. The second floor, the gay bar, the upstairs, and the third floor, they say, is used for sleeping. I don't know what that means. Happily, nobody was there at the time of the fire. Somewhere along the way, a fire erupted in the building. We think we know the cause of it. However, we promised the police in New Orleans that we would not discuss the cause until more information had been developed. Whatever happened, flames rushed into the air conditioning unit, spread throughout the bar, and before the Holocaust was over, 29 of my brothers and a sister were burned to death. I met the sister was non-gay. She was there with her two sons. There were other non-gay people in the bar. 29 dead, an enormous number wounded sufficient to require hospital care and then made ambulatory. 15 wound up in the hospitals. At this moment, at the time recording the show, the hospital count is down to 10. 4 are in exceedingly critical condition. 1 is in guarded condition, and 5 are in fair condition. Expectations are that not quite all will make it, I'm sorry to say. So, in New Orleans, we found a lot of things waiting for us. We found a good deal of misunderstanding, the makings of an anti-gay pogrom. Some kook called one of those television talk shows and said that he represented a group called the Black Mamas and the White Mamas, using a showbiz term. This is not all that racist, it's just the term he was using, and that they were going to carry on vigilante action against us, and particularly against me and Reverend Troy Perry, who had also come to New Orleans.
When I flew in the next day, I made my reservations, and I got on an airplane, and I went.
Reverend Troy Perry.
And it was unbelievable. People were scared to death. I've never been in a city like that.
The station asked my opinion of that, and I said, well, I advocate freedom of speech. I think all words should be said, but occasionally some words can be really harmful. And it's possible that kind of statement could set off a chain reaction of people who might indeed get the idea that it would be a lot of fun to kill a lot of gay people and burn a lot of gay bars and make our lives miserable. And thus we knew that part of our problem was to counter that kind of thing.
We had the police department who had just announced through Major Morris, head of the detectives for the city of New Orleans, that it was a place that were frequented by thieves and queers, and that was a quote in the newspaper. Well, we called a press conference, and we immediately attacked that concept, and we said those were our friends, those were our brothers and sisters, those were somebody's sons and daughters and mothers and wives, etc.
He had said also that it was well-known gay people don't carry proper identification, and thus we would never be able to identify the bodies. The Times-Picayune called to ask me my response to that, and I said, well, not very good. I think at this time the police need to be calling for compassion and warmth and love and understanding, that there is a major tragedy upon our hands, and that we need to be responsible and responsive at this time. And if that police person has those kinds of ideas, I would like later on to talk with him. But right now I don't want to talk to him about that. I want to talk to him about the fact that we have a duty to the dead and to the wounded and to this community and to their families.
Of all things, the newspapers immediately swung to our side. I've never saw any. We got an apology out of the police department. The police denied they had ever said that. But anyway, immediately we started our PR work.
Also, we had suspected that we would be treated as outside agitators, and we were.
But we went out, and it was just horrible, and people were scared to death. They were afraid that other bars in the city were going to be firebombed. There was that kind of thing. So every night we walked the streets of the French Quarters and went to all the gay bars. I made sure people knew we were there, and we walked around saying, we're outsiders, true, but we're not afraid, and we want to let you know you don't have to be afraid.
We were suspected also that the community there wouldn't understand who it was very well, and it turned out it didn't.
We started talking to people all at once, people who had never talked before, gay people who were involved in this organization, that organization, but they never got it together. All at once, we started there, very calmly, very quietly, saying these are things that have to be done. We have to do this. This is all there is to it.
Many of the victims of the fire were holding their hands over their mouths and saying, please don't say to the public that it was a gay bar.
Morris Kite.
We said, fine, we respect your wishes, but it's in every guide in the country as a gay bar. Everybody knows that. Can't we now at this time say to the world, yes, indeed, we're gay and we're proud and that we have a duty?
And it was unbelievable.
Reverend Troy Perry.
That we received such oppression in some ways. I started calling churches, try to get a place to hold the memorial service, and everybody turned us flatly down. We were not the type of group they wanted us in the church. But luckily, all at once, we got a phone call from St. Mark's Methodist Church, a church that's pastored by a black man with five white women on the board of directors. So they were used to being talked about anyway. And they said, we have met and we have decided we want you to use our church. It was in the Quarters. And we held the memorial service there. And the bishop of the Methodist Church attended the memorial service, Bishop Crotchfield. He was the only dignitary from any church group that would come. And he said, I'm quite aware that there are gay people in the United Methodist Church. And I want to let you know that everyone is not bigoted just because, he said, of the feeling that you've got here. But it was a feeling of pure fear. I have never felt that in my life. I'm too used to California where here I know everybody and his brother, and I'm not afraid of the chief of police. I mean, with all the oppression here, I'm still, you know, I do know people. But there, for once in my life, I got a feeling of pure fear. I know what blacks felt like in some areas of the country. I really do, of walking around, a real fear for their life. But I've learned a long time ago, we can't sit around fearing death. We have work to do. And if you do that, you can't do anything. You'll never get anything done. So when we left there, we felt like there was a real unity. I told the people over at the memorial service, I said there wouldn't be any cameras. Well, TV showed up anyway. We kept them out of the building. But I announced the last thing, and I said, I'm sorry. I said, but there are TV cameras. And I said, I have found out there's a side entrance, and if you want to go out, you can, and nobody will see you. And all at once, people started screaming, no, 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 we're all going out together out the front door of this building. And AP, UPI, and the Times-Picayune, which is the largest newspaper in Louisiana, moved over by my little side door. And as they reported, no one left by the side door. Everyone marched out with their heads high.
In January 1974, Reverend Perry's Metropolitan Community Church Los Angeles dedicated its new sanctuary, replacing the one destroyed by arson 6 months before the fire in New Orleans. Morris Kite brought the spirit of the upstairs lounge to that occasion.
their flowers here from the mourners in New Orleans saying, "United we stand." The reason for that phrase is because indeed, united we stand. Without that, there is no standing unless you stand united. But the magic of that song is that at the upstairs lounge, it was like an anthem. Every Sunday afternoon, it was sung by the people there. And they were singing it when the flames came rushing out and sucked the life out of their lungs, and the Reverend Perry and I and others went there to bury the dead and to heal the wounded and to succor their needs. United we stand, divided we fall. And if our backs should ever be against the wall, we'll stand together. We'll stand together, you and I.
I'm Reverend Troy Perry, and I'm listening to This Way Out, the international LGBTQ magazine.
There's a whole lot more queer history in the popular podcast, A Queer Serial. Our John Dyer V got a lesson.
Militant revolutionary homosexuals are on the attack.
Think someone spotted the guns in their purses?
The completely true story of a newfound minority.
And you will be caught.
Can you sneak us out through the back door?
We are the people our parents warned us against.
And it seems inevitable that the mob will pour in.
From secret societies to Stonewall.
Devlin Camp is the creator, producer, and host of the podcast A Queer Serial, covering the foundation of the early gay rights movement in America. Season 2 picks right up where Season 1 left off in the year 1954. Camp's rat-a-tat delivery style is breezy and a little deadpan, as if dishing the latest dirt. We are quickly brought into a large cast of characters as we learn about the genesis of the social, political, lesbian support group, the Daughters of Bilitis, or DOB, named after a faux historical contemporary of the archaic Greek poet Sappho of Lesbos. Moving between multiple scenarios, we hear further details of the nascent men's gay activist and social group, the Mattachine Society. Background on the harrowing legal and societal conditions for would-be gay folks, mainly in L.A., New York City, and San Francisco, gets stirred in with the Mattachine men and our busy ladies of the DOB. Also included in the tea are the surprisingly heroic proprietors and owners of the mushroom-like bars and nightclubs catering to the gay, trans, and gender nonconformist clientele in these cities. This is quite a bit of bouncing around, so one has to keep up with all the snippet-like story threads. Hearing about the arbitrary cruelty and injustice of politicians and legal authorities towards these communities is really depressing, so the fun interspersed cabaret songs by various beloved performers of the day helps lighten the often serious tone.
The girl I marry will probably be as butch as a hunk of machinery. The girl I idolize will wear slacks with fly fronts, tailored shirts, and bow ties. A faint-hearted fairy, the girl that I marry won't be.
That was writer, singer, and songwriter Edith Ide, who created the pioneering lesbian publication Vice Versa under the pen name Lisa Ben. Did you catch the anagram in her name? In listening to the first 5 episodes of this podcast, we are privy to an astonishing level of detail, and grateful reference is made to literary and other sources. A later episode delves further into the past, and we are given a breakdown of how and why San Francisco became the freewheeling and notoriously open-minded haven for all forms of gender and sexual expression. The one constant remains conservative outcry and legal crackdown on what is perceived to be degenerate and amoral behavior. Sometimes you just want to say sour grapes. Like one magazine is created for Mattachine Society members in and outside of the U.S., the Daughters of Bilitis create The Ladder, which is an informative and instantaneous success. The FBI keeps close tabs on both groups as gay and lesbian activism takes place slowly but surely. Yet another episode goes all in on pioneering sociological research conducted in the 1950s by the great Dr. Evelyn Hooker, who made the revolutionary claim that gay folks were absolutely normal. She further stated that the emotional or mental anguish they suffered from was caused by abuses from others, whether family or authorities, and having to live in constant fear of simply being their authentic selves. Hooker was a married heterosexual woman, which actually helped her to get funded for such groundbreaking work. She was also loved and trusted by her subjects, some of whom also became dear friends.
The first guideline, which seems to me essential in working with gay men or gay women, and I think they're the same, as I think the guidelines are the same, the first essential is that one must have an attitude of total acceptance of homosexuality or lesbianism as a viable and equal alternative lifestyle.
Camp has clearly done a ton of research and squeezes all of it into each moment, breaking segments up further with mentions of other podcast productions. Family and friends are also pulled in to help with the different character voice bits, making Camp one busy producer.
United we stand, divided they catch us one by one.
A queer serial. Subscribe now on Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
If you're looking for a really deep dive into a fascinating and essential part of not just gay, but human history, pop on over to Apple Podcasts, Patreon, or Stitcher, and have a listen to A Queer Serial by Devlin Camp, now in its second season. For This Way Out, and for history, I'm John Dyer V.
Thanks for tuning in to This Way Out, brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. Some program material this week came from Brian DeShazer and Wenzel Jones, produced by Brian DeShazer, and from John Dyer V. One Direction and Elton John performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Ivana Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, and donors David Hunt and Richard Merck and Brad Payton of Silicon Valley. Look for This Way Out Radio on social media, email tworadio@aol.com, or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon and all of us at This Way Out, I'm Lucia Chappell. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org and on 2RRR Gladesville, New South Wales, WELT Fort Wayne, Indiana, KICI Iowa City, Iowa, and a wide array of community terrestrial and internet radio stations around the world, including this one. Stay healthy, y'all, and stay tuned.